Hello and welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast from Revenue Rockets for this last week of July 2020. I'm pleased to introduce somebody many of you know already from listening to the podcast, Ryan Barnett, Vice President here at Revenue Rocket, and a new voice you haven't heard from before from Revenue Rocket. CJ Strell is a fantastic, super smart analyst that we work with here to provide some words of wisdom as it relates to looking at companies to acquire. With that, Ryan, I'll turn it over to you and CJ.
Sure. Hey, thanks, Mike, for the introduction. And CJ, we're really glad to have you here working with us in Revenue Rocket. And you've done some great work with us and our clients that has really helped increase the valuation of our firms on the sell side, as well as give insight from buyers into what they're really buying and how to optimize that purchase. So today, we're going to ask a few questions around what things matter within the kind of financial due diligence process, as well as what happens when companies do merge together. So, CJ, welcome.
Thanks, Ryan. Really appreciate that. Yeah, when you think about due diligence, really what you're trying to do is reduce the volatility in the transaction, right? I think we're all really familiar with when you go and you buy a used car. There's a lot of information that the seller has that the buyer doesn't. And so whenever you're doing that, it causes a lot of friction in the transaction. And to the extent that you can reduce that friction in the transaction, you're going to get really better outcomes. And those better outcomes are going to kind of come in a couple different ways. One, the deal's going to get done probably in a much faster manner. But second, the confidence level that both parties have when it comes to the financials, the operations, and really how these two organizations are going to fit together. Those are the type of things that when you can reduce that volatility, all parties are going to win. The seller is going to be in a better position from a standpoint of being willing to move forward with the buyer. And the buyer is going to have a lot more confidence that what they're buying is actually what they're buying. And that's probably, the biggest concern that a lot of buy side groups are going to face is, how do I know that what I'm actually paying for is there? Yes, all the stuff that comes with culture and merging two groups together and making sure that the strategies are aligned, those are important. But there's also that feeling that's kind of in the back of your head, like, do I actually know what I'm getting? And that's really a part, that's really kind of the piece that due diligence brings. It brings that level of confidence and it eliminates that friction in the transaction.
That's right. And a little bit of a background, when we do a search on behalf of buyers, the first thing that we're really looking for is a strategic fit and a cultural fit. And if those two things can align and you can get the technology that you're working with and how you're working with the processes and technology out there, those can align well with the culture, typically the financials will come in line. To your point, we don't really even start due diligence until we get those things aligned and then start into the financials. But let's assume that we are working with a buyer and we've identified a good target and they've agreed to come to the table. CJ, what's the first thing that a due diligence to start with, and what kind of things should a seller be prepared to show to a buyer when that due diligence starts?
Yeah, so a lot of this is the kind of the bread and butter that everybody would expect. You're just going to start out with really getting into the balance sheet and the P&L. Most people are going to mainly focus on the P&L to understand the revenues and expenses and what type of levers there are in that P&L that are driving the profitability. But as you kind of peel back the onion and you begin to look at the connections between the P&L and the balance sheet, that's where you can start to really find out, are those numbers in the P&L, are they really what's happening? And as we all know, when you decide to sell your company, you're beginning to act typically in a way that's a little bit different than you might. And as you begin to do that, we can actually see those changes in behavior based upon how the financials change over time. So that's kind of where you start. You get into that P&L, you get into that balance sheet, and you can actually see, you can see a lot of different things that you may not know are actually there. Yeah, after you get past those two items, there's a lot of different areas that you can kind of drill down into. They give you a lot of transparency into the business functions.
Sure. When you're starting to into those diligence and collect this, and this is very similar. So when we're working with buyers, the first thing that we typically do is evaluation, in which we look for 5 years of financial P&Ls, and then we also ask for a 5-year forecast, essentially to help with a discounted cash flow model, and then pair that with a few add backs that are going to adjust the EBITDA figures going forward. Is there anything else that's kind of critical for a seller to think about that a buyer is going to ask for when starting that first initial request?
You know, in addition to obviously the balance sheet and the P&L, buyers should be really interested, and the sellers should be prepared to provide some of the underlying contract information. Obviously, this is going to happen. But after all the non-disclosures have been provided and the letter of intent is in place. But it's really interesting the types of information that you can find sitting down in the contracts that underlie that, those revenues. And most of the time as a buyer, you're really focused in on that, either that recurring revenue or the sustainability of that revenue, how chunky it is, these type of things. As you get down into some of the customers, you're going to actually kind of see how that plays out. And sometimes when you get into some contracts, there's things in there that you didn't necessarily know about. There might be volume rebates that you weren't aware of. There might be different type of clauses that are beneficial to the customer and not to the company you're acquiring. Those are one of those areas where, yeah, you got to kind of get down in the details sometimes. And you're not going to look at every single customer because, you know, that's a lot of work, but you might want to focus in on some of those key customers that are really critical as a part of the deal.
Sure. The biggest ones are going to drive the rest there. Is there any, if you were to start with perhaps a list of red flags that you might see, you just mentioned a few there. Are there any other red flags that a buyer should be kind of keeping their eye out when they're starting the process?
Yeah, Ryan, that's a great question. And I think that this kind of speaks to the value and the purpose of the due diligence process that Revenue Rocket provides. I'd say, you know, some of the key things are, the first is recognizing a potential change in behavior of the seller. So once a person has decided that they're going to sell their business, some of the expenses that they may have been running through their business in the past, they may start changing that. They may be doing things to accelerate revenue that they may not necessarily have done in the past. And when you look at those couple of years of financials, Ryan, you can really kind of see that there'll be some points where things change. And understanding how those things change impacts how you're going to be valuing the company, because the cash flows will change. And, you know, if you look at it over 5 years, you'll notice the difference between the 4 years where they were operating as a going entity, and that maybe last 6 months to a year when they thought, oh, you know, I'd like to go and sell myself, and I want to try to get the premium value that I can get. And in order to do that, I might have to either, you know, improve my revenue or improve, you know, reduce my expenses. And some of that's completely legitimate. Sometimes, though, you can push the envelope a little too far, and it may be a situation where that business won't actually be able to have a sustainable run rate of whatever that EBITDA looks like. Other areas that we see, you know, concerns would be quite often in employee expenses. And this is kind of routine. I think it's one of those situations where we find it, I would bet, probably 75% of the time. There are a lot of employee expenses that are kind of guaranteed expenses. There are things that are going to get paid to the employees. And those liabilities typically aren't recognized on the balance sheet. And so when you're doing your due diligence, there's often lots of little accruals. These are like little, basically, liabilities that the seller is on the hook for. And we need to make sure that we capture those in the valuations so that moving forward, the buyer is able to recognize those expenses and not actually have to deal with them post-transaction. There are ways to manage that post-transaction, but to the extent that you can capture those costs ahead of time, obviously it makes for a much smoother transaction. You know, there's, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's things like rebates. Obviously accounts receivable is something that usually kind of catches everybody's attention. Obviously, you know, accounts receivable is something that it has a relationship to revenue. And to the extent that those two kind of stay in line with each other and those ratios stay, you know, in line, it's an area that doesn't necessarily cause too much concern. But especially when you get a kind of a significant variance between revenues and AR, it kind of tells you a little bit about something that's going on in the organization. And it tells you a little bit more than just, oh, of course, they've got some aged AR out there and we need to make sure that we understand it, whether it's appropriately been addressed via a bad debt expense or something like that. But it also tells you something about the underlying business as well. And so I kind of like to say it this way. There's a lot of technicals involved and in these relationships between the P&L and the balance sheet, but there's also a story behind the story. And I think that's one of the big messages that our due diligence process can give you, some insight of what's the story behind the story in the business. And that's probably worth just as much as all of the different little liabilities and stuff that we might catch along the way, because that's going to give you some of that confidence to know, yeah, that business is running the way I expect, or no, it's not, and let's make sure that we capture that in the context of our valuation.
Sure. That's great. That's great info, CJ. And either for Mike or CJ too, just want to talk about add backs for a second. I mean, you mentioned what might be the ongoing expenses that are not perhaps captured in a P&L or sitting in accruals in a balance sheet. As a buyer, how should a buyer evaluate add backs in general? I mean, how legitimate are they to actually projecting the value of the company or giving the value at the time of the purchase?
Well, from my perspective, I would say that add backs are legitimate provided they're unique and are one time and or are standout, meaning they're not going to continue post transaction. I think oftentimes buyers discount all addbacks, or they want to discount all addbacks as a negotiation tactic. We think that's a bad idea. We think you should legitimately look at those expenses and see, were they one time in nature, or were they such that they're not going to continue post-transaction? Because as a reality, if they don't continue post-transaction, you are going to see that uptick or change in EBITDA post-transaction, and it will impact your return rates. And I think as a result, they can be legitimate. Sometimes sellers want to put everything that they ever spent money on into add-backs, and that's where you get into a bit of a conflict with a buyer and a seller. Because if a seller is too robust with listing addbacks that just frankly are considered normal costs of doing business, like investments in marketing or investments in, a good example of that might be investments in sales and marketing staff that didn't work out, right? They're like, well, it didn't work out, so we should add back. Not really, because I think there's going to be fits and starts with salespeople anyway, right? You have to have a sales function. You're spending money on the sales function. You could have maybe overspent because someone didn't work out, but it's tough to make that a legitimate add back. CJ, I don't know what your opinion is.
Yeah, I think that I think there's another category too of add backs that sometimes gets a little dicey. And I'm going to call it this synergy add back. And what I mean by that is where a seller is kind of looking at something in the future that they believe that they may decide to implement, or they might be in the process of implementing, and they believe that it's going to have a material impact on the P&L. And so they want to kind of capture that potential benefit in an add back and try to basically capture that synergy. And I think that this is where, you know, buyers and sellers, this is where there's some negotiation, right? I would say on the buy side, when I see those come up, I'm like, no, those are for the buyer. The buyer gets to capture those synergies and we need to go to the table and make sure that we're capturing them for our buy-side client. And, you know, I will say there's some negotiation there, but I do see that happen where, you know, sellers are thinking, oh, yeah, I definitely have these like lower expenses coming in the future, either A, because I'm doing something, or B, because I'm going to do something. And in my perspective, either way, buyers got to really look at that and say, nope, that's for me. That's why I'm taking the risk in this transaction. I get to capture that.
Yeah, that is great, great, great advice. And if someone leads into to a bit of my next question is, you know, what advice would you give to a buyer to start to predict a rate of return? And we've worked with a number of clients to forecast how to come kind of to the realization of ROI in ROI on a deal. And I'm wondering if do you have any general advice on how do we start and what's the most important part to generating a return on investment model? What kind of financials should we look at? What kind of other elements may be thought about in predicting that return on investment?
I could start out with this, Mike, and then you could kind of fill in kind of some of the bigger picture on this. At a detail level, I think one of the things that Revenue Rocket has some great experiences with is really understanding some of the key industry benchmarks when it comes to performance. So company performance, whether that's, you know, at a EBITDA percentage of revenue, whether that's at individual line items on spend, be it marketing, things like this. Really having an understanding of all of the kind of key levers that businesses can pull and understanding kind of like what is a best in class percentage? What is a kind of middle of the road? What is kind of a underperforming percentage when it comes to these kind of key performance metrics? Those are the type of things that I think really start the benchmark process when it comes to understanding kind of like how you're assembling kind of what does this organization look like going forward and how to value it. And, you know, I think that's really critical in helping you kind of determine where you're going to, you know, what kind of valuation you're going to put on that target. And I think that it kind of ties back to a little bit of due diligence here. We're able to look at some of those individual line items when we go through this process and give you some of that feedback to understand like, yeah, they're kind of a best in class in this area, or, you know what, they're really underspending in marketing or something like that. And that could have a longer term impact on the valuation. But really understanding those key performance indicators and where they kind of fit in that spectrum of best in class to kind of mediocre, I think really helps kind of form the basis of that valuation. But that's kind of in the detail world, my perspective. Maybe you could comment on that, Mike.
Yeah, you know, I think that is true. We certainly have a perspective of doing this for a long time and looking at a lot of sets of financials. And I think, you know, being able to provide advice and counsel as it relates to, you know, what's normative and what's not normative and sort of what would be considered acceptable or not. And it's part of what, because we're focused exclusively in this space in IT services that sets us apart, I think, from many. Certainly there's many very competent M&A advisors out there, but the lion's share of them don't really focus as narrowly as we do on IT services. And I think that brings some unique perspective that we bring to the table that certainly we can share with you and you can help you think, I think, more accurately or even more differently about how you approach this topic.
Great. That makes sense. I want to, again, switch gears a little bit from that rate of return. Sometimes it seems like due diligence, it's critical for companies to do, as buyers to do diligence. But I'm curious, Mike, you know, what's the line of the right amount of due diligence? For example, when does due diligence ever kill a deal that perhaps shouldn't have been killed? So, Do companies sometimes get into an analysis paralysis, or do they look at the negatives out of the deal compared to the potential of the win going forward?
Yeah, I think you can always talk yourself out of a deal based on discoveries, potentially in due diligence, right? I think it, you know, M&A comes with risk and you have to be prepared to take some level of risk. And if you're going to begin to talk yourself into, well, what if this happens and what if that happens and what if they lose this customer and that customer and, you know, what if we have something happen in the future that's not foreseen? You can talk yourself out of that. And oftentimes, after a certain amount of due diligence, you might begin to have those conversations, either in an executive committee or as an individual buyer. And we've seen many individual buyers that should do deals, certain types of deals, choose to not because they thought something might happen in the future. And, you know, and we all know it's pretty difficult to predict the future. We try to de-risk deals by doing comprehensive due diligence to make sure that what's been disclosed is accurate and that we have confidence in the strategy moving forward. But, you know, we were taught some lessons early on by, you know, some of our mentors and clients and friends, and many of them look at, you know, internal rate of return, and do the analysis and say, hey, if you're going to get to an IRR that's north of 20% or less than a five-year payback, you should do the deal if the rest of the due diligence checks out and you have a good confidence in the forecast, that it's not that it's supported by either the contracts that are already in place or that are, you know, the history of the firm. And I think, you know, as much as you don't want to get deal fever and do a deal that doesn't pass the sniff test from due diligence in a forecast, you also don't want to get what I'll call sort of talk yourself out of a deal based on things that might occur. You have to make the decision based on the actual data you have, and to remain, to keep the emotion out of it is pretty critical. And being able to, you know, take that risk and ultimately move forward. And we'd certainly recommend you do that. Part of involving an advisor in that conversation helps you do that, because organizations like Revenue Rocket, we're not caught up in the emotion of, well, if this happens or that happens, or this person leaves or that person leaves, then this might happen or that might happen. We don't tend to go there. So we can be an objective third party to say, yeah, but what's the real likelihood of that occurring? And this is what we see, and this is our sort of non-emotional recommendation.
Yeah, CJ, I'd like to add to that. Opposing take on that?
Yeah, actually, I support Mike's perspective on this. I think that, you know, due diligence should not be something that's causing kind of people to fear the deal. It's actually the opposite. Due diligence should be the thing that, you know, accelerates the deal and allows that friction to go away. If you remember the example I kind of gave at the beginning, you know, I think that one of the benefits we have at Revenue Rocket is that I'm able to get involved pretty early in the deals to kind of understand what is the strategy of the deal and what's kind of the main purpose and why are these two organizations coming together. And I think when you start kind of with the end in mind, with understanding how these two organizations can come together, I think that it helps you give perspective on the context of the due diligence you're looking at. You know, it's one of those things where there might be lots of little issues, but if the deal works, you just work through those things. And the due diligence should work to support and to actually create that less friction so that the deal can happen, you know, in a more timely manner and to get up and moving faster. Conversely, once in a while, you're going to come across a deal where you find information that's just really, it kind of strikes to the whole concept of the strategy. And in those cases, you know, that's where you got to have some really tough conversations about the assumptions that were made and what we're actually finding. But either way, those are good things. Those are things that you want to have happen. And it should be our job, specifically one of my jobs in the due diligence process, to make sure that we start with the end in mind and that the stuff that we're talking about is relevant to you as a buyer and is supporting your kind of goal of your strategic vision. And you know what? Sometimes, I'll be honest, sometimes you can get down in the weeds a little too far. And, you know, Mike does a nice job of reminding me, hey, is this really a part of the big picture? And I think that that kind of balance helps provide you as a buyer with the confidence that you're getting the best advice.
Yep, exactly. And part of this, I'm very curious, and this might go to Mike as well. When you're looking at a letter of intent, when a buyer issues a letter of intent, it's non-binding, with the exception of the NDA clauses. But there's usually terms associated with the deal, perhaps an amount and perhaps the payment terms that are in that LOI. I'm curious, and either of you can chime in on this, when you have extended due diligence into a company, how often do you see a deal retraded because of the due diligence? And where does that sit in line with the issuing of the LOI in the first place?
Well, you know, as a matter of course, we don't typically see deals, a significant number of deals retraded. And the reason why, I think particularly if we're representing a buyer, we've done enough diligence to know kind of what a fair deal would be and a structure would be prior to issuing that letter of intent. Now, it's a delicate balance, right? If you go too deep into the analysis before the letter of intent gets written, you'll never get to the letter of intent. Oftentimes, sellers get sort of deal fatigue early if they don't know what the structure of an offer is going to be, and they're just not prepared to provide you with the level of diligence you might need to move things along. So I think, you know, this is a area where you have to have enough information to be able to create an offer and do it in a meaningful way that gets agreed upon or negotiated by both parties. And, you know, that's ultimately what sets the value of that seller's businesses, is when you have a willing buyer and a willing seller. But our experience has been there's not many deals that are retraded. Now, with that said, I would say that there's hundreds of things to negotiate in an M&A transaction after the letter of intent is signed. So, you know, there is a little bit of the old adage, you know, what the definition of retrading is, because there's certain components of the deal that certainly have yet to be negotiated that can impact overall value. And, you know, we don't necessarily see that some of those minor deal points that impact value as to be a wholesale retrade. Generally, when we think about a retrade, we think about something that is found in due diligence that would cause you to completely start the negotiation over vis-a-vis acquiring the business. And so, CJ, I'd love to hear your opinion.
Yeah, the way I think about this, Mike, is there's the P&L world, and then there's the balance sheet world. So let me talk about the balance sheet world first. You're not going to really retrade a deal based on the balance sheet items typically, because when you're doing the transaction, there's two places where you can make adjustments to that really fall within kind of the normal M&A structure transaction. You know, you're going to have at close a working capital calculation, and then down the road, you'll have a true up. And basically, just think about that as, you know, there's a certain amount of capital that needs to be in the business when it's transferred to the buyer, so that the business can have an ongoing, you know, functionality from a cash flow perspective. And when you have balance sheet items that are incorrectly valued, typically what that means is you're going to be making adjustments to the overall balance sheet, and those changes usually just flow through the working capital calculations. Now, that's kind of a standard step in our process, and so to the extent that you have, I will call, normal types of adjustments, that's where those are going to be captured, and that's really an effective way to capture it, because it's a part of the process. It's expected. The seller is going to be expecting that, and if you do your due diligence, if you engage us in that, you're going to have a very effective and timely way to take care of those things. If you have a P&L issue, now that's a little bit different. The question on the P&L, is it a one-time type of an issue, or is it a sustainable kind of systematic problem? I think the systematic problems are the ones that have a tendency to impact the deal valuation more. And so that's where you might actually have a discussion about a retrade. To the extent that it's a one-off, again, that's something you can adjust. You can really adjust that through the working capital of the true-up timeframes. And so, you know, I think that generally speaking, you know, you're trying to stay away from retrades because it's usually kind of a poor experience for everyone because you're kind of changing those expectations. But if you have a systemic issue that you find in the P&L, it's probably going to be impacting the cash flows. And to the extent that those are significant, yeah, you're going to have to take a look at that.
Yeah, very good. I'm going to ask one more question here, and we can wrap it up. But I'm curious. We have worked with buyers who have issued a quality of earnings report, and I'd love to hear both of your opinions on the efficacy of the reports, and you know, when does it make sense to actually go and hire another third party firm to go do that kind of quality of earnings report, and what value comes from that compared to perhaps a lighter form of due diligence?
Yeah, I'll weigh in on that, and then I'd love to hear CJ's opinion. I mean, certainly depending on the governance of the buying, the buyer, and sometimes quality of earnings reports are required. Oftentimes, private equity requires a QV separate from any other advisors in the transaction and a sort of independent review of the financials to deem them to be correct. And it's just another set of diligence and provides additional comfort for investors and buyers. With that said, I would say that, you know, that it's not an inexpensive endeavor. You know, typically a quality of earnings effort is a $50,000 to $75,000 expense. And depending on the level of governance with the buyer, you know, may or may not be required. Oftentimes we do not find material changes to, and I can't think of one actually, where we've represented a buyer or even for that matter represented a seller for which QV had been done. There just isn't material items that are found in those analysis. Doesn't mean that, you know, couldn't happen in a transaction. Certainly there's a very significant level of review that is done as a quality of earnings. And it can certainly unearth things that have been missed up to that point. But typically, if you have a good group of folks that you're working with, they're going to have found really any of the open items that will have been found through a QVE. CJ, what's your view?
You know, when I think about the investment that a buyer is going to make into the due diligence process, whether that's through our program or through a quality of earnings review, I think it kind of has to start with, like, what do you think that return on investment is going to be? I mean, because you're spending real dollars here. And there's a lot of different factors I think have to go into your thought process when it comes to return on investment. I think you got to think about kind of the risks associated with the business that you're buying and where those type of risks and how significant they are in the context of kind of how much variability it creates in the cash flows. And let me give you an example. Like, if you have a business that has pretty obvious standard recurring revenues, you know, you might look at that business and you can pretty quickly get into the financials and there's not a lot of volatility or variability around it. And to spend $50,000 to $75,000 on a $5 to $10 million deal, that could be pretty significant. I mean, that's pretty stiff, and that might not make a lot of sense. However, if you had a business that had a lot of project accounting, a lot of complexity in how they're recognizing revenue, lots of maybe deferred revenue out there that you got to wonder, is it, you know, how much exposure is out there? It might make sense to spend that money because there's a lot of exposure there. I really think you got to think of it in the context of, you know, how much risk do I think is there versus the return I can get on this investment? And I mean, that's really the decision that a buyer is making on everything that they're doing in an M&A transaction. And I would encourage them to kind of think about, you know, think about that due diligence piece of whether it makes sense to hire a third party to do it, or kind of using, you know, the Revenue Rocket model. Because at the end of the day, these are your dollars and you should be getting the return on investment that you're expecting.
Yeah, that's great. Well, that's all I have for you guys today. Mike, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, we appreciate it, CJ. It was great bringing you into the podcast this week. And with that, we'll tie a ribbon on it. We look forward to recording next week's podcast. Take care. If there's anything we can do for you, of course, you can find us at revenuerocket.com or info@revenuerocket.com via email. Thanks.